In this episode of Keeb FM, we got a chance to speak to Z and hear about their journey through Kubernetes, from the evolution of their home lab to tackling some of the thorniest challenges in the field. Things like managing secrets, persistent storage, and choosing the right ingress solutions. Z really brings it all to the table, from powerful advice on how to start with Kubernetes to choosing the right OS for home lab setup. Spoiler alert, Talos Linux makes an important appearance in this episode. Plus, Z also shared with us why publishing failures and learning from them is one of the best ways to grow in this space, and how building real connections at conferences has transformed their experience in the community. Whether you're just starting your Kubernetes journey or have been in the ecosystem for a while, Z's insights are sure to resonate and inspire you. So grab a coffee, settle in, and let's get into it with Z Yasso. This episode is sponsored by Nutanix. Is there a single platform for running Kubernetes in AI anywhere? Yes, there is. The Nutanix Cloud Platform is the ideal choice for cloud-native and AI applications, supporting all major Kubernetes distributions. With Nutanix and Kubernetes, you can scale your production seamlessly while simplifying your operations. To learn more, you can find the link to the Nutanix website in the comments. Now, let's check out the episode. All right, so first things first, what do you do and who do you work for?
I do developer relations stuff, writing, site reliability things, a lot of things. And right now, I work for myself, which I am saying is a company that totally exists on LinkedIn.
And how did you get into cloud native?
So when I started my career way back before the current age, I ended up getting into cloud native stuff kind of by accident because AWS's free tier existed. And cloud native stuff ended up being kind of cheaper. And when I managed to get rid of some of my existing responsibilities that required like stateful Linux servers, don't be an IRC systems administrator. It sucks. It is a lot easier to just adopt a cloud native workflow where the compute isn't really all that persistent, except in cases where it needs to be. But even then you can limit it if you try.
And so what were you before you got into cloud native?
A college student, where I got a PhD in dropping out.
And, you know, the Kubernetes ecosystem moves very quickly. How do you stay up to date? Is it with blogs? Is it with podcasts? What works best for you?
Well, the Kubernetes ecosystem, I kind of don't stay up to date with it unless there's something that changes that directly impacts me. Like, I have compute, network, and storage covered, and as far as I care, that's all that really matters. So I don't really keep up with it per se, but if like big things do get announced, they get sent my way and I end up reading about them.
If you could go back in time and share one career tip with your younger self, what would it be and why?
Have a blog, write. Publish what you write, publish what you learn, publish what you succeed at, and more importantly, publish what failed. Because humans learn from failure a lot better than we learn from success. So if you really want to learn, publish the stuff that went wrong. It's something that is kind of anti-ego because, you know, it's admitting that something went wrong and you're not perfect. And if you're not perfect, why should they pay you capitalism dollars? Like, yeah, it's actually even more important to publish what went wrong than what went right. And when I publish things like my entire saga of rebuilding my home lab, I made sure that I kept what went wrong and what I failed at, because that information is critical.
And with that in mind, you know, it's for our audience, Z is a very prolific writer, and you know, your blog has more than 400 articles ranging in length and topic from things like meditation to WireGuard. We didn't have the chance to read all of them, but one in particular stood out, which is titled, Do I Need Kubernetes? It was published in August of 2022. The article isn't what we would say is short, but let's just read it a little bit out loud to you so our listeners can get some context. No, but I think do no. That's what we saw. What was your thinking process then, and how has it evolved in the following 2 years?
So first off, frankly, I'd be amazed if you read them all because it's actually closer to 500 articles at this point. I haven't done the calculation that leads to an updated thing, and there's some automatically generated articles from a template like no way to prevent this, say users of only language where this regularly happens. but I'm pretty sure it's closer to 500 at this point. And I think the only person that's read even close to them all is my husband. Bless that man's heart. The general reason why back then I suggested against using Kubernetes for everything is because at some level, Kubernetes is the most generic tool ever created. It is something that is adaptable from running on Raspberry Pis to operating, what's the name of the, like F-35 planes with like Istio and, you know, Chick-fil-A with their restaurant stuff. This is a blessing and a curse because, like, Kubernetes is, at some level, really simple at its core, but the combination of being declarative and eventually consistent can really mess with people. And the fact that at the time that I wrote that, everybody and their dog seems to have built their business on top of the idea of layering our random crap on top of Kubernetes so that you get a allegedly usable results, and it's just a big old pile of like configuration YAML spaghetti, and I hated it. The thing that really sucks though is that Kubernetes sucks all the oxygen out of the room. So Docker Swarm, it's basically dead at this point. Mesos, yeah, if you're the everything app, maybe. Nomad, there's a glass ceiling, and once you hit it, you will run into really weird issues where prod will just die, and you will have no idea why, because you hit the glass ceiling of Nomad and have to basically throw it out and start over.
I know you mentioned your home lab already, but you know, as part of our monthly content discovery, we found an article that you wrote, Rebuilding My Home Lab, Suffering as a Service. Setting up a home lab has become increasingly popular among developers wanting to learn Kubernetes. We've had quite a few guests who have also spoken about their home labs. What made you decide to rebuild yours, and why mention the suffering so much?
The main thing that made me want to rebuild it is that my ideal for my home lab is I've compute as a faucet. Spotify, a while ago, expressed the product vision as music as a faucet. You turn on Spotify when you want music, and you turn it off when you don't. I kind of want that with my home lab, where I'm just able to say, go do this somewhere, and it complies. And in my previous setup, I had to think about things like what nodes were running what processors, what storage was available locally, what GPUs were attached to it, and that did work, asterisk, but it was cumbersome, unwieldy, and overall just not worth the effort. So when I was remaking my home lab, I wanted to make something where I could just like give it things to do and have it do them without me having to write custom software to make that happen. And ideally without having to SSH into the machines for any reason.
Now, the choice of operating system is often crucial. Two previous guests that we've had on the podcast, Mircea and Ghazal, explore different approaches, Talos and Bottle Rocket. However, we noticed that you started your home lab journey with Rocky Linux. Tell me more about that.
So when I started out, I actually did some research with the community management practices of the various things that I was adopting, because I have had some bad experiences with tools that I will not name for their community management approach being subpar, and Rocky Linux seemed like it had a pretty good community management approach. I also chose it because I wanted something based on Red Hat, because Red Hat is boring. It's well understood, it's easy to Google for, and in worst possible case, the AI companies have hoovered up all the documentation, so you can just ask the Torment Nexus to generate you some stuff, and it'll probably work. I also, kind of frankly, don't want to have to care about the configuration my home lab uses as long as it works. And the machine that I tested it out on initially was probably a mistake to grab, but at the time, my old Mac Pro, the Trashcan Mac Pro, was my most idle node, and it was running Prometheus, but nobody's going to die if my Prometheus server goes down. So I used that as my testbed. And that's when I ran into the first issue where Rocky Linux detects that particular model of Mac Pro as needing an HFS EFI partition instead of a FAT32 EFI partition like the rest of the world. that Mac model is fine with a FAT32 EFI partition after a firmware update, but Rocky Linux doesn't know how to check the firmware version or something, so it assumed it needed a Mac EFI partition and did not have the tools to properly create it, so the only solution was to manually install Rocky Linux, and yeah, no. I didn't want to rebuild the ISO. I didn't want to do painful hacks. I didn't want to manually install because, like, that's caring about the configuration. I don't want to care about the configuration. So at that point, it was less effort to just give up and use something else. Also, to manage things, I wanted to use Ansible because people had told me that Ansible has gotten better. I don't know if we're using the same software because it was exactly the same level of suffering for me. Complete with YAML grammar being fun and the Norway problem and the secret extra YAML problem, the Ontario problem. Do you know about the Ontario problem?
I was just going to say, for people that aren't familiar, such as myself, can you tell me about the Ontario problem?
Okay, so YAML has a bunch of values that can be interpreted as true and false. They are T, F, true, false, yes, no, on, and off. NO is the ISO country code for Norway. ON is the province code for Ontario. That actually ended up causing me some problems because I was trying to brand the location of the machine in Ontario, you know, where I live, and it got put into the configuration as true. And it failed because it wasn't a string. And that's when I gave up. And also, in general, using something like RHEL or Rocky or something and Ansible means I have to SSH into host to do things. And like I said, I don't want to SSH.
So it's clear that Rocky wasn't good enough, so you moved on to Fedora CoreOS. Was the CoreOS part of it that led you to it? Perhaps some good memories? Tell me more about that.
My career started about the time when the first, like, legacy CoreOS stuff was in public alpha. And at the time, CoreOS was the first immutable Linux operating system that you could just download and use. It was way ahead of its time. It had Docker as the only way to run programs on the machine, and it had this really innovative thing called Fleet. Fleet, for those of you that don't remember it, is distributed systemd. You give it a systemd unit, and it runs it somewhere. And you can look at the logs, and it will give you the logs from any node in the cluster. It was beautiful. And that ended up dying because of Kubernetes, of course, but if I had infinite time and budget, I'd probably go back and remake Fleet or update Fleet to the modern era because it's just so good.
Now, during your search for alternatives, you looked at several specialized distributions like Rancher OS. What did you find in that process?
Way back in the CoreOS era, there was also this OS that was released by, well, Rancher, called Rancher OS. And it took the minimalism of CoreOS to an even deeper level, where the only thing that was really running on the system was Docker. When you turned on the computer, it would do two things. It would boot and initialize hardware to the point where you get a network stack up, and then start the system Docker to start things like the DHCP client or the user Docker thing that you interact with, or the SSH daemon. And every time you SSH'd into it, it would create a separate Docker container for you to do system administration tasks in. It was absolutely nuts, way ahead of its time. And it ended up not really taking off because you couldn't apt install things to it and people weren't ready for an aptless life.
After evaluating several options, you settled on testing Talos Linux. Why was it so compelling, and how did it end up comparing to others?
Talos Linux initially came on my radar when I was speaking at All Systems Go last year, and the person after me was from Sidero Labs talking about how Talos is crazy minimal. And that reminded me of another thing that I use for a Raspberry Pi mounted inside one of my home lab nodes as a IPMI of last resort, where it called GoCrazy. GoCrazy is, I don't want to say it's a Linux distribution because that isn't totally accurate. It's more of a Linux implementation. It's closer to Android than it is to like actual desktop Linux. And everything except the kernel is written in Go. And it's a bunch of Go services that start on boot, and the init is written in Go and listens on port 80 for HTTP updates. It's frankly wild. I love it, but it's not really prod-worthy. Talos Linux struck me as like kind of like Go crazy, but prod-worthy. And that's why I ended up picking it up, because Talos Linux, kind of like Rancher OS, does two things on boot. It initializes the hardware enough to get the network stack working, and it launches Kubernetes. That's it. That's the whole thing. It's like 11 binaries in its default configuration. It's nuts. I love it.
After installing the operating system, you often need passwords and whatnot to install the rest of the tooling. This is probably an uneventful thing for most engineers, but you found an interesting twist to this story. Can you tell us what approach you ended up taking for your home lab?
Yeah. In general, I try to avoid passwords and the like as much as possible. Passwords are, well, I think they still are the industry standard, but they're starting to wane out of existence because passwords just kind of suck. It's a credential that is easy to copy. It doesn't prove anything other than knowledge of that credential. And, you know, you can exfiltrate passwords and use them for ne'er-do-well needs. And Talos Linux, I believe, uses CA certificate authentication out of the box. It creates a ClusterScope CA for like 10 years, and your kubectl configs also use the same, your Kubernetes client configs also use the same certificate authority. It might use a different sub certificate authority, but either way, it works enough that I don't care how it does it. And it's pretty great.
With the secrets out of the way, it's, you know, now time to install the rest of the tooling. Package management and Kubernetes is, you know, quite a hot topic. We recently had Brian Grant joining the show to discuss the history of Kubernetes resource model. Also, other guests that we've had, Jacko and Alex, had their turn to bash Helm, saying, you know, design is fundamentally flawed. It sounds like you went through a similar experience working with Helm in this setup. Is that correct?
Yeah, I had to use Helm for some things, like the one password operator to make managing secrets easier, or I think Ingress Nginx or something. There's a bunch of stuff that I have. I think Longhorn's in there too. Maybe the WireGuard operator I use. Either way, I do use Helm for some things because there was literally no other option. And for that, I use a tool called Helmfile, which allows you to list all of the charts and repositories in a single YAML document. Then you run Helmfile apply, and maybe it does what you want. It's good enough that I don't have to think about it, and that's all I really care. And as you mentioned, yeah, my incredibly spicy take is that Helm is the right tool with the wrong implementation. I was looking this up on Stack Overflow to try to find the exact thing that they were using, but you know that one legendary parsing regex, HTML with regex answer where the person just slowly descends into utter madness and, you know, here comes Zalgo, Tony the Pony, he comes, whatever. And one of the things that it mentioned is that XML is a level 3 language and regex is a level 2 language. And that kind of strikes me as the same way, because YAML is an object. And a lot of the current best practice is to do string templating of YAML, a white space sensitive language. This works, asterisk. It is not elegant, but it does somewhat work, asterisk. And in general, Helm is using a level 2 language for a level 3 task. And, you know, it kind of works. You have to use the indent helper and the dedent helper or marshal things to JSON or whatever. But honestly, about half the reason I try to avoid Helm as much as possible is because at employer -3, we had machine-generated Helm templates that were all of the pain of Go templates and YAML and template expansion and all of that fun with none of the advantages of it. And in general, that nearly burned me out to the point where I considered quitting the industry entirely. Like packing up from tech and just doing something else with my life. Because if this is the direction our industry is going, it's a lost cause. But I think that Helm is now mostly avoidable thanks to Customize. I kind of wish Customize had better support for like replacing exact variables and things, but you can use patches for that, and patches are probably a superior model anyways. Like machine generated patches with the machine spitting out JSON, because all JSON documents are YAML documents, asterisk.
And, you know, it's kind of a known fact that persistent storage and databases are two of the fundamental challenges in Kubernetes. How did you approach this in your home lab environment?
So in my home lab, I use several different container storage implementations. I have three tiers of storage, as it were. I have Longhorn for stuff that I want to be replicated between computer boxes and automatically backed up to the cloud. And that's for things like my Giddy, my virtual machine disk images, a bunch of other stuff. I think one of my most used things has a SQLite database on top of Longhorn in a 1 gigabyte persistent volume claim. And 1 gigabyte is probably overkill, but you can't size it down easily. So it's just how it is. The second tier is NFS to my NAS via the NFS subdirectory provisioner. And that is used for things that require bulk storage, are accessed infrequently, and I would be okay if the data was to mysteriously vanish one day. And then there's a third tier, which is using CSI S3 to Tigris. Disclosure, I am contracting with Tigris. I am not a representative of them. I just really like what they do. And I use CSI S3 with Tigris because it is great for workloads that have a lot of data that is accessed infrequently, and I don't want to keep it locally. Like, I run a Discord bot that does all the archives of DJ sets for an online radio station that I volunteer with. And all of those radio sets are stored in Tigris with CSI S3 so that people can download them, and it will just treat it like a normal download. It will go from Tigris to my thing to the IngressD server to them, and that kind of sucks, but it works enough.
Off script, but would you care to share the radio station?
The what?
You mentioned the radio station? Would you?
Oh, yeah, Ponyville FM. It's electronic music. It's a lot, but it's usually a lot of electronic music, dance music, trance, that sort of stuff.
Very cool. Good. Well, it's a fun fact. Nice to have. Now, with storage sorted out, you needed to handle external access to your services. What solutions did you implement for ingress and DNS?
Okay, so when you're designing this kind of stuff, everything's a trade-off. There are reasons why you'd want to do certain things over other things, and there are limitations that you need to keep in mind when you're designing it. I am an online streamer. If you haven't been an online streamer before for things like Twitch, one of the golden rules of thumb is that you never expose your home IP address in DNS ever, because people will find it. And they will send you a lot of love letters at like 20 gigabits per second and take down your entire home internet connection and your ISP. So with that in mind, I needed a proxy somewhere. I chose Vulture arbitrarily, and I made a server in Toronto that has the dumbest TCP proxy ever that proxies TCP to the right. It actually proxies over WireGuard inside the Kubernetes network to the cluster IP of the Ingress Nginx service, right? And goes that way. So when you go to something that's hosted via my home lab, it goes, you know, from the internet to IngressD to the Ingress Nginx thing, and then Ingress Nginx does whatever it does to get to the right service, to get to the right pod, and then, you know, responses go all the way back. At some point, I'm probably going to upgrade that to more than one node, but I haven't had to care, so I haven't yet. But IngressD is something that I just wrote for myself. It's probably like 120 lines of Go at most. It's the dumbest TCP proxy ever, and it works, so I don't have to think about it.
You encountered some interesting DNS-related challenges. Could you possibly elaborate on the issues with cluster naming conventions?
A while ago, when I worked in SRE, one of my SRE mentors told me, never, ever use fake domains for production stuff, because undoubtedly, someone else is going to publish it to public DNS, and then your entire thing breaks. This is advice that started springing up around the time that Google announced the .dev top-level domain, and a lot of people that were using .dev for their internal development stuff were just, you know, left high and dry and kind of screwed. That is why when I set up my cluster, I used a subdomain of a domain that I already own, something that's in public DNS, and something that would allow me to get Let's Encrypt certificates for those names. Because, you know, I don't want to have to maintain my own CA, especially because that makes endpoint security software raise their eyebrows so high they go into orbit. And because I did this, I ran into a lot of interesting issues due to the ecosystem assuming that nobody changes the cluster DNS name. There was not rejoicing. Eventually, I ended up finding some Stack Overflow answer somewhere that suggested, oh yeah, if you do this, you're probably doing it wrong, but to fix it, just copy the config for your custom domain to cluster.local and it should fix it. And I followed that advice and it just fixed it. So yeah, it did work. But in general, I have several names set for clusters. I have my home lab, which is all REST, and in the future I'm going to have three clusters in the cloud somewhere, and they're going to be Radamanthus, Minos, and Aeacus, I think it's pronounced. I've never heard it pronounced before. But they're references to a JRPG that I like, where they had the planet called All Rest, and they had three space elevators named Radamanthus, Minos, and Aeacus.
Now, it sounds like a lot of effort went into the setup. I assume there were a fair amount of lessons learned from all the challenges you faced and overcame, but the work never really ends, right? How do you think it could be improved?
The big important part, though, is that I've gotten it to a point where I can just put a deployment service persistent volume claim and ingress into the mix, and it will just work. I put those resources in, it will create the right DNS things, it'll create certificates, it'll route things to the public, and in general, deploying to my home lab is easier for me than deploying to the cloud, even when I worked for a cloud provider, which is the part that honestly kind of still messes with me. But a lot of the stuff that I'd like to improve is really like ergonomics, like making it easier. When I did Kubernetes the time before I did the home lab, I ended up using a configuration language called DALL, D-H-A-L-L. Think of it as JSON with functions, imports, and types. And there was a DALL package for Kubernetes, and I used that to make an app.dall that had some basic configuration things that were exploded out into whatever the hell Kubernetes wants. I would like to have something like that, but at the same time, I also kind of like that I just have a giant folder full of Kubernetes stuff. All of these things are with customize, and I can just run kubectl apply -k dot in that folder, and it will just redo everything in case something gets messed up. It is really great. I need to have the other thing I'd probably do is have CI automate that deployment, but it's, as you know, complicated, especially when you have a home lab cluster where the Kubernetes administration port is not exposed to the public. So you need to have like some WireGuard set up or some GitHub action thing. And then you run into the issue where GitHub actions in Kubernetes have weird permissions requirements that they don't document, because why would they document what it requires? Why would anyone do that? That's not how Agile works. And like a lot of the stuff that I really want to improve is just ergonomics, making it simpler. If there was a web UI that didn't frankly just suck, I'd probably use that. I have been told to try like Argo CD or Flux, and my last experience with Argo CD was suffering as a service, so I'm kind of inclined to not use Argo CD.
You think you'd give Flux a try?
Maybe. I frankly am trying to avoid adding too much complexity, because the thing that I really like about this right now is that it's simple enough that I don't have to think. And like recently, someone on my patron Discord asked me like, hey, you moved your home lab to Kubernetes a few months ago. What are your thoughts on like the experience using it? And I ended up saying like, oh, I just realized that I haven't had to think about the individual nodes in a while, and I just put stuff in there in on the end, and it just works. So that was really, really nice.
Now, you're very generous with your knowledge and your prolific writing, and we started out, you know, the episode talking about writing about the things that don't work, you know, putting that out there so people can be aware of that. Based on your experience building this home lab, what advice would you give to others that are starting their own Kubernetes journey?
Well, the first bit is plan for today. Don't plan for tomorrow, which might exist. Plan for the today that you know exists. And in my case, what I wanted to do with my home lab is get three things set up: compute, network, and storage, because those three things are the fundamental building blocks of any deployment, of any workload in anything. And when I started it up initially, I got compute and network via WireGuard so that I could access the cluster internal service names with my browser. And that was the stopping point at first. And then I tried to figure out persistent replicated storage between the machines, which due to various challenges involving Talos Linux pod security profiles, instructions not working because components decided that they should rewrite themselves in Rust for fun, and other various creative decisions in terms of how you install and operate things, I ended up settling on Longhorn because I was able to make that work, and it continued working after I rebooted all the nodes. And the continued working after rebooting all the nodes bit is the important part, because that means that if it continues working after you reboot it, then you don't have to think about it until it becomes a problem. And in general, you're not going to get to the absolute perfect. Know your end game. Find a stopping point you can live with. And if you do, in fact, reach a point where you can just do stuff, that's where you stop. That's where you stop modifying things, and that's where you start adding things on the side. Like, when I got it set up initially, I just had Longhorn as storage, and then later I added CSI S3 and the NFS subdirt provisioner. And those were things I added on the side, and things that are optional to the deployment. Or I added Kubevert into the mix because I wanted to run virtual machines on the cluster. And now I'm having difficulty spinning up new virtual machines on the cluster because Longhorn broke something in an update and, of course, did not tell anybody that they broke it. Why would they? So that's going to be something I have to figure out at some point. I wanted to do some content around using Kubevert on my home lab and Kubevert in general, and I'm going to have to figure out how to work around that or something. I don't know. probably just end up doing nested virtualization in Hyper-V or something. I don't know. I am completely making this all up as I go along.
Well, the honesty is appreciated. We're getting towards the end, and you recently gave a talk about not wanting a booth at conferences, but making real connections with the people who attended the event. And now, in my personal experience, I've been organizing events, participating in events for a long time, and I was fascinated to hear that, that take on things. Would you mind sharing the gist of this with our audience about, making memories, not booths?
Sure. So, at a high level, when you have a booth with a company at a conference, you get a badge that has the Page Shill tag on it. I don't have one within immediate grasp where I'd pull it up and show, it says sponsor, or as people will interpret, Page Shill. And as a result, when people see that, the interactions become transactional because, that's what they're used to. They're used to people, they're used to holding up their badge and then getting their soul scanned with the little QR code thing so that marketing can bug you about adopting our multi-cloud storage architecture or whatever the hell. And frankly, I understand why those things exist. I understand that, people need to cook their metrics in order to survive capitalism. But I don't want to do that, at all. So a lot of this strategy around focusing on personal interaction, talking to people like humans and having actual human conversations with people that understand what they're talking about, is what sets you apart. And especially not giving people bits of stuff that's just going to end up in a landfill. I'm pretty sure that you're going to link to the talk, Guerrilla Event Planning at Larger Conferences, in the show notes.
Yeah. Totally will.
And that is actually how that word is pronounced. I had to look that up at least 12 times.
Okay, to make texture sure. That's okay. That's a double learning experience. I guess, have you seen any events where you would say, such and such an event gets us correctly, or this is how you do it?
So one of the local meetups, there's not really that many local meetups in Ottawa, because even though it's a G7 capital and they claim it's a tech hub, all of the meetups died over COVID. And the only meetup really worth going to, in my opinion, is the AI meetup, because they go out of their way to make sure it's not just paid corporate shills as a service. And, it's focusing on actual human contact, networking, talking with people, sharing interesting things, building interesting things together. At the last meetup, they had someone come in with a desktop PC with an absolutely sketchy number of GPUs in it, doing Stable Diffusion live with a webcam. This man stuffed 3 4090s into a single mid-tower chassis. I was logistically impressed at the creativity involved in putting 3 4090s into that case, because a 4090 is a 4-slot card. That's the kind of stuff that I like. I'm hoping that the Montreal AI meetup that I go to next week is going to be more like that.
I hear you what you're saying regarding, a lot of meetups dying over COVID, and most meetup organizers would agree that diet or haven't come back fully, getting people to attend events in person is tough. So much content being available online. And I think it's a risk for a lot of us of not having that face-to-face interaction. And then having the other extreme of, like you said, in larger scale events where it is very much based on servicing, sericing sponsors and very transactional interactions that happen very quickly. And meetups provide a more, close-knit community feel where you can share something. It can be big, it can be small. No question is too junior or too stupid. It's a very welcoming atmosphere. And I definitely lead the local Kubernetes meetup here in the north of Spain. And it's a wonderful, but we don't try to hit 150 people attending. For us, if it's 15, it's great. If it's 20, fine, whatever. So I definitely agree with you on that. Now, you're very busy and very active. So what's next for you? What can we expect next from Z?
I've been starting to do 4-hour streams on Fridays on Twitch, And I think I'm going to be making some absolute trash fire of a mistake involving dynamically spinning up and down instances on this really weird website I found called vast.ai, or as I have been referring to it in my notes, sketchy GPUs as a service. It is this bit-acquired compute marketplace where you can have, like, these GPUs at prices that are so unrealistically low, it makes me think some of them are, like, either former cryptocurrency people trying to get as much return on investment as they can, or, like, money laundering. And
we're both...
Yeah, it's absolutely nuts, but there is nowhere else on the planet you can get access to an RTX 3090 for 2 cents an hour. Like, no, that is actually a price I have seen. So this week, at time of recording, I'm probably going to be writing a Kubernetes operator to automatically provision, start a model, and then run HTTP, and then run inference on an HTTP request. So I'm going to have, like, some absolute crimes going on. And I'm going to have to deal with the Kubernetes operator SDK, which is, I mean, it's fine, but I have more of a background in writing idiomatic Go, and the way that operator SDK works just makes my insides boil a little. I mean, I understand why it has to be as complicated as it is, but, like, I just wish it wasn't. Either way, it's going to be fun. It's going to involve reverse engineering API calls with the browser inspector, putting curl commands into ChatGPT to generate Go code. It's going to be a wild ride.
Sounds really cool. Great. If people want to follow you and get in touch with you, what's the best way to do it?
I have a contact page on my blog, zyasso.net/contact. That is X-ray Edgar India Alpha Sierra Oscar dot November Edgar Tango slash the word contact slash.
Perfect. We'll also link in the show notes. Z, it was wonderful having you as a podcast guest. Thank you for sharing your all the information that you provided, your knowledge, your experience, sense of humor as well. Very much appreciated. I hope our paths cross somewhere in the world. And if not, we'd love to have you back as a guest on the podcast. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm going to be submitting a CFP to KubeCon EU, and I would be going to KubeCon this year if it wasn't in a state where it's literally illegal for me to go to the bathroom in. So, like, if I get KubeCon EU, maybe we'll meet up there. Otherwise, who knows? Small internet.
Agreed. Hope to see you in London. Take care.
See ya.